Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hi, I'm Scott Hahn, and I'd like to invite you personally to join me and Breadbox Media on August 24th in New Oxford, Pennsylvania, for a day of spiritual renewal. I'll be presenting three talks, one on St. Joseph, one on the sacrament of matrimony, and another one on the Holy Eucharist. Learn more and register at breadboxmedia.com/PA conference. I hope to see you there.
Celebrate our God-given freedom and faith while honoring our Blessed Mother with Ghirelli's USA Rosary. Each state is represented on this rosary's 50 beads. Red, white, and blue enamel adorn its patriotic crucifix. Get yours today. Shop www.ghirelli.com.
Good morning, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio 980 on your dial. Glad you can make it tonight, and glad that we could make it tonight to be with you, my fellow truth seekers. We are here Monday nights until 11 p.m., as always, bringing you a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Tonight, ladies and gentle things, together we delve beneath the surface on the topic of the dignity of work. Yes, you heard me right. The dignity of work. And to assist us in this endeavor is my fourth Monday evening guest of the month. My guest and yours, the one, the only, the unimaginable, Mr. Kent Niebuhr.
Thank you for your hospitality. I'm glad to be your guest and everybody else's guest.
Yes.
Someone let Mr. Ed in. And our guest tonight,
I guess so,
is Mr. Ed.
Speaking of Mr. Ed, Mr. Kent.
I wonder if anybody...
Wilbur in real life, yep, just died 2 days ago.
You got to be kidding
me. I think
me.
His name was Robert Young.
Robert Young, huh?
Yeah, he was actually not too young. He was in his 90s.
I don't guess he would be.
Yeah.
Wow. How...
Have you ever seen that on MeTV or any of those
stations? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, I used to watch it as a kid. I remember watching Mr. Ed as a kid. I haven't seen it in years. And, of course, as a kid, it was already in syndication and reruns. So it was quite a classic at that point.
Oh, it was great. It was great. I loved Mr. Ed.
You know, I stumbled across The Honeymooners again recently.
As you should. It was a great show.
Oh, my goodness. What a fantastic show that was. Humor, like... it's lost. That classic humor of that era is just lost.
Totally lost.
It's sad. It's sad.
Yeah, I never understood. Jackie Gleason's bursting out angry character.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt bad for his wife. Always.
Oh yeah, you know, it's funny because I was showing my kids one of these Honeymooners episodes, and my wife walked in the room and she said, "You know, I never liked The Honeymooners." I said, "Are you kidding me?"
Because
it's
of
hilarious.
Jackie
and
Gleason's
she said,
character?
"He's so mean to his wife."
Yeah.
And I said, "Right, but he gets his comeuppance, doesn't he?" He always gets humbled.
He usually does, yeah.
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 Right.
Audrey Meadows. If I remember correctly. 978-454-4980 is our phone number here at BTS Radio. 978-454-4980.
And let's not forget Art Carney.
Absolutely, Art Carney. And Trixie, his wife.
Of course, Trixie.
No question.
Yeah.
And of course, Jackie Gleason and Art Carney were the prototype for Fred and Barney Flintstone.
Exactly.
Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble.
Pretty much imitating their voices, even.
Yeah, yeah, it was amazing. Their personalities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same show, except can we take The Honeymooners and put it in the Stone Age?
And that's what you do, yeah.
You get the Flintstones.
You get the Flintstones.
Right.
All right, so if you want to give us a call at 978-454-4980 on our upcoming topic, which is the dignity of work, or any topic of your choice, please feel free to give us a call. We would love to converse with you as we discuss this important topic. All right.
Ralph Cramden worked as a bus driver. Fred Flintstone worked at a quarry.
I can't get away from this. That is a good point. That is a very good point. They were both blue-collar workers.
Blue-collar workers. They got up in the morning. They got themselves to work, and they were always looking for, in order to supplement their regular income, were always looking for a crazy harebrained scheme, as Alice.
Now, it's interesting. I don't think we should get off of this topic because this does relate completely to our topic of the night.
It does, doesn't it?
Because they had that kind of work. It was blue-collar work.
Exactly.
And of course, Ralph Cramden, I think he also... Was he also in the quarry? I mean, what did he do for a living? I don't remember.
He drove a bus.
Oh, he did too?
Yeah.
Both of them did?
No. Fred Flintstone worked in a quarry.
No. I'm talking about...
Art Carney.
Yeah, Art Carney.
Art Carney worked in the sewers.
Did he really?
Yes. Ed Norton worked in the sewers.
Ed Norton, yeah.
He had a sewer job.
Okay.
Yep.
Very good.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mr. Trivia here.
I'm just a trivial guy.
You are. And, of course, Fred Flintstone worked for Mr. Slate.
Exactly.
And
about Barney Rubble? What did he do?
I think he worked in the quarry, too.
Did he also work in the quarry?
I think so.
Huh.
Yeah.
I can't recall.
And, of course, Archie Bunker worked in something similar.
Yeah. He worked at a dock, didn't he? A loading dock?
I believe so.
Yeah.
All the way up until he retired, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, most people work up until they retire, I think.
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, they work, but they do various jobs.
Sure.
Like working on a loading dock is
one job for your entire career.
Yeah,
oh, that's, yeah, he hung in there. Of course, he's a fictional character.
So, in a lot of these characters we're talking about, their work is highlighted. We know what they do. We know the kind of personality they have. Before we get into the philosophical and theological underpinnings of work, Kent, do you believe that a person's work either causes or reflects their personality type?
You know, I guess I would say that ideally it ought to. I would say generally, you know, there are certainly exceptions to the rule, but generally people kind of settle into a job, a career that either attracts them because it reflects their personality, or when they take the job, they tend to imbue the job with their personality.
Yeah.
It seems to be the case. I'm just trying to think of my work experiences.
Well,
seems to happen.
Traditionally, there has been sort of a distinction between white-collar workers and blue-collar workers,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Maybe political jargons is... the working class and the middle or upper class.
Sure.
Do you think that there are different personality types that are attracted to either one of those two realms of work?
I would say so. Yeah, it does. That does seem to be the case. However, I've also, you know, I've in my own work experience, I really have an eclectic work background. I've worked white collar, I've worked blue collar, and I've been a stay-at-home dad.
Yes.
So, and of probably a few of each of those. And what I would say is that what I've learned from that sort of somewhat broad spectrum of experience is that it's really a mistake to pit these classes against each other. At least ideally.
Do you think they are being pitted against each other?
Well, I mean, if you take Karl Marx, they're certainly pitted against each other. Right. It's the struggle between the classes defines all of human history, according to Marx. I mean, I think he's wrong,
but
ultimately wrong. But that's not to say that there is no struggle between the classes. But I would say that the struggle between the classes is more because the classes are not recognizing their complementarity. People who are not in management, let's say, tend to complain about management all the time.
Yeah.
And people who are in management tend to complain about the rest of us all the time. But the reality is we're all complaining that things aren't achieving the ideal, the office isn't run or the operation isn't run as it ought to be run. Mm. And I think what you're coming up against there is not that, oh, we have bad management or, oh, we have bad employees. But what you're coming up against is that everyone's trying to make an enterprise succeed. And
Wait. You really think so?
Yeah.
You think that, are you saying that that is what is happening in effect, or that is the motive of each worker?
No, I think the motives of individuals at their extreme tend to be, I want to use the word selfish, that might be too strong a word, but people get a job because they need money, right? Yeah. Most people don't say, I don't care what I get paid, I just want to do such and such for a living. Now, there are people who end up in situations like that, but generally speaking, if you were getting paid nothing, if you were getting...
All right, let's look at that, and I'm going to throw that out to you. There are two big motivations for working and choosing the job that you choose. Number one is that you want to do something positive for the world.
Sure.
For the community. And you think that you have what it takes, whether it be a talent, a gift, a desire, what have you. You think you have what it might take to do good for the world in this particular job. Versus, I don't really see any particular gifts or talents that I can give to this job, but it pays a heck of a lot of money. And maybe I can get rich one day and have a lot of things, and hence I'm going to go work towards that job. Now, what do you think is more fulfilling, going for the money or going for the type of work that could contribute to what you think is important, even if it pays very little money?
Well, all right, this might sound odd, but I don't think the two are mutually exclusive.
Well, sometimes they can be.
They can be, certainly. You could say, I'm just doing this for the money. I hate the job, but yeah. I'm just doing it for the money.
But what I'm saying is, I think there's a lot of jobs that people with certain personality types that they don't pay all that much money. Teachers, for example.
Sure. Right.
Other kinds of
most
jobs.
Public servants. Most
yes.
of them.
Yeah. And if that's what people feel called to do,
right?
They have to make a decision. Either I'm going to do what I think is really important, yep. or I'm going to do what I think is going to make a lot of money.
Or it doesn't have to be those extremes either, because I myself. Was a teacher for a while, and I thought this was a fantastic way to spend your life, but I also had a family and I had to get out of it because I just couldn't afford to teach.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I was in a certain degree of it, if you want to say, is charity, right? I'm doing this because I love it. That's what charity ultimately means. I'm doing this because I love the job and I love the good it does in the world.
Yes.
Nevertheless, you got to eat. You got to put a roof over your head. All these things, right? Unless you're going to say, you know, I'm going to be all Franciscan about this and I'm going to, you know, sleep on the floor and I'm going to have one set of clothes that I'm going to wear all the time. And of course, then you'll run into problems with your job. Right? How am I going to go to work every day as a school teacher if I'm wearing the same clothes every day and I'm sleeping on the sidewalk?
Yep.
Right? So you can't really do that, especially when you have a family involved. So it's not either I want to be a millionaire or I want to, you know, go to some godforsaken place and help the poor. Those are two real extremes, but I think most of us operate in a blend of those two, where we have the job we have for two reasons. Ideally, we need to make a living, and it's something that we feel has some value for society as a whole.
Yeah, but you're not really directly answering the question. If somebody really, truly, and fully feels called to teach because that's the gift they have and that's how they can, they think that that is extremely important for the community,
yep.
and it pays very little money, yep. and they have a family, what do they do, or what should they do?
I would say first and foremost, someone who has a family is called, like you said, they're called to be a teacher, they're called to be a father, mother, and a spouse. That's their primary vocation.
That's right.
Right? That's their primary calling. So what they do to facilitate their primary vocation of parent and spouse is important, but it's of secondary importance.
So they have to give up their secondary love.
Sometimes you do, right? Ideally, you could make it all work together, but ultimately, you have to fulfill those primary things. Now, can you be a good father and a good husband if you're living on the streets with your family? I'm sure I know for a fact there are a lot of great people in history who were homeless. However, it's awfully hard. You can imagine to juggle that, to pull that off.
978-454-4980, our phone number here at BTS Radio. I'm Paul Morano. That's Kent Niebuhr. Our topic tonight on Beneath the Surface is the dignity of work. Right after this break, we're going to get into the more philosophical and theological underpinnings of work and talk all about that. So don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back. 978-454-4980. The phone number here at BTS Radio, or you could just jot your comments down at facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. All right, Mr. Kent, we're back. And before the break, we were talking about the dignity of work. And let's start getting into what is work? Why don't I start with that question? What is work, and how do we distinguish it from play or leisure?
That's a really good question, except I don't think my mic is on. There we go. That's a really good question. I think what you have to think is some sort of productivity, right? If you're a farmer, you're producing produce.
Yes.
Right? If you're
producing produce,
If you're, you could be sitting in a cubicle at a desk pushing papers around, but somehow, even if it's remotely connected to what you're doing, someone somewhere beyond yourself is benefiting from it.
In terms of you're producing something as a part of a community, would you say?
Yeah, I think what work generally what work generally consists of is contributing somehow to the overall good of your society or of humanity, right? Now, you could sort of lose this if, you just decide, I'm tired of society, I'm going to go live on a mountaintop somewhere and just... But this is really... Would that person in solitary existence somewhere in the middle of nowhere, would that person be working?
Well, that's a good question because he'd have to eat, so he'd have to work for his food.
He would have to exert effort, right?
Yeah.
However,
kill his own food or whatever he's doing.
Exactly.
Or grow it.
Yep. But however, you can't just reduce work to exerting energy or exerting effort because you could say, well, I went for a jog. That's not what we would call work, right? I mean, it's physical exertion, but we wouldn't call it work because we don't see it as contributing to the greater good.
Then would you call work necessarily does work necessitate pay? Let me put it that way. Compensation.
There has to be a fruit of your labor, right? There is some way it has to sustain you, right? Whether it's pay or not, because you could just take, in a strict sense, a hunter-gatherer going out to work means he's going out hunting and gathering, and he benefits from this, and his family or his tribe or his whatever benefits from this by what he gains in hunting and gathering, right?
In a sense, that's his pay, right?
That's the pay, right? Yeah. And I think... Two, we all too often reduce, now as this is speaking as a stay-at-home or former stay-at-home dad too, is that work doesn't just involve getting a paycheck, right? Because
as we just said with the hunter-gatherer.
With the hunter-gatherer, you're not just you're not getting a paycheck.
Or the farmer.
But you're working and you're producing something, right? Yeah. You're coming up with something.
Right.
The fruit of your labor, right? And the same thing with parenting, right? If you're a stay-at-home dad, stay-at-home mom, what you're doing is you're producing, at the very least, you could say good citizens, right? You're producing or looking...
Forming, educating,
you're forming adults.
Of,
yep. There's a Catholic psychologist named Ray Guarendi who says, you're not raising children, you're raising adults, right?
Yes.
Because that's the fruit, right? And you're sending these adults out into the world. So that's your contribution to society, you could say.
Mm.
Right?
All right. So then why does, in your opinion, why does work have a negative connotation?
I think because we tend towards laziness, right? We tend to think it, the fruit of my labor ought to be leisure.
That should be the fruit.
Right. I mean, yeah. If you just think in general of retirement, right? I'm going to work for 50 years and then I'm going to do nothing but golf or something, sit on the beach or, right? You think that the fruit of labor should be non-labor, right? However, that's great. And leisure is extremely important. We need to restore ourselves. We need to rejuvenate ourselves. However, it's not that simple. Right. The fruit of our labor should be a roof over our heads, food on the table, clothes on our back. The fruit of our labor should be even a portion of that for those who can't provide that for themselves. Right. And historically, we've had our elder relatives living with us. Right. And even if they're beyond their so-called productive years, we work so that we can take care of them. I sort of kid around when I tell my mother has always said forever and ever, you know, oh, I don't ever want to be a burden to my children. Right. So, you know, thinking that I'm never going to, you know, live with my kids, I'm never going to. But I always tell her, well, Ma, you know, roughly speaking, you supported me for roughly 20 years. So when you can't support yourself anymore, I'll give you 20 years. So, you know, but after when that 20 years is up, you're on your own. You might be 99 but that's it. You're out looking for a job.
All right. So then basically you're saying that the reason why work has a negative connotation is because due to, and I'll go further than you, due to original sin, the imbalance within us seeks towards laziness and towards sloth.
Right.
Work is sort of the opposite of that. So let's go, why don't we, back to the book of Genesis this notion of the dignity of work. It seems like before sin entered the world, mankind was going to work and his work was going to be pleasurable. It was going to be beautiful. It was going to be fun, if you will. It was going to be paradise, part of the paradise that he lived in.
You know, I often describe it as before the fall, before Adam and Eve sinned, Adam was a gardener, right? Just like a lot of people today, they say, oh, what are you going to do when you retire? Oh, I'm going to work in my garden.
Yep.
Right? Or what'd you do this weekend? Oh, I worked in my garden. I love working in the garden. There's just something about being out there and the, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then after the fall, Adam was a farmer. He was working hard. He was backbreaking labor.
By the sweat of your brow.
By the sweat of your brow, thorns and thistles and all that. So what we have, our experience of work tends to be that sweat of your brow, backbreaking, thorns and thistles type of work. Whereas what, and the only thing we can, we kind of go to these extremes. It's either all or nothing. We're either busting our butts or we're sitting on the couch with the remote control.
I would offer to you the possibility that if Adam didn't sin, that he wouldn't have simply, and all of humanity wouldn't have simply been gardeners. That might have been part of their role to garden food. But I think the evolution of society would have and could have happened in a way, I mean, not similar to ours, because ours is stifled by sin, but in a way that is unimpeded by sin. So, what I'm trying to get at is that whatever the work is, whether from gardening to high tech and beyond,
right?
If sin did not enter the world, it would have been fully and completely pleasurable. Yes.
Sure. Yeah. We would have all, to put it in sort of modern forms of speech, we would have all really enjoyed our jobs. We would have all felt that our jobs were rewarding, right? Whether or not we were getting rich.
Totally fulfilling.
Yeah. We would have felt that our jobs are just sort of, you know, bring out the best in us.
So then came disobedience and selfishness and the seven deadly.
Sure.
And so now we're in the condition that we're in now.
Yeah.
And no matter how much you love a job, no matter how excited you are at the beginning of it, it eventually gets old, stale, and you don't like certain parts of it.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of, it's like anything else. You know, it's funny, I remember a friend of mine once said that when she was, I guess, a teenager, an adolescent. Her mother told her, you know, it's funny. So often the very thing that attracts you in the first place to the person you marry is the thing that gets on your nerves the rest of your life. Now, you could look at that with a job, right? You see a job and you're like, oh, they have this, they have that. It'll be like this, it'll be like that. And then all of a sudden, the things that attracted you kind of get old, maybe, or even they're just not. I think what we tend to do with jobs, just like a lot of things, we think, you know, here's the great analogy. I always kid my son Daniel about how when he was probably in second grade, maybe third grade, he said, all I want for Christmas is a Bakugan and a DS, right? These two toys that were popular at the time. And then I'll be happy.
A Bakugan and a DS, yeah.
All I want is a Bakugan. And
I think we can all relate to
we
that
all do
attitude.
That. We all
I
do
want
that.
Is X yep. or
if
Y.
If I only had yeah. this job,
right.
then I would be happy.
Then, yeah.
But what?
Exactly.
The elusive happiness is not the fault of the job. It's that we expect a human being to be utterly fulfilled in their work. Now,
oh, I think it's more than that. I think that the fellow human beings that we have to live with
oh, sure.
in every single job are less than perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that it makes it even more intolerable sometimes.
Exactly. There's no getting around that whatever goods we have in our lives, they're not infinite goods. They're not complete goods. Right?
They're partial goods.
They're partially good, right?
Okay.
Every person in our life is somewhere on this spectrum of goodness. Every job, every, you know, your car, right? Oh, I love my car, but I had to take it into the shop, right? Because it needed to be fixed or something.
Yeah.
So all these great goods in our lives are not infinite goods. They're not perfect goods. They're not ultimately fulfilling. However, it doesn't make them bad. We can't go from one extreme to the other and say, well, my job didn't turn out to be as fulfilling as I thought it would be, so I'm going to look for another job. I'm just going to trash it, and I'm going to go look for another job. The reality of work, you know, I often say, there's a reason why they pay us.
Yeah.
Right? Because if they didn't pay us, we wouldn't show up. In most cases, right? I guess there are some people out there who would do what they do for free, but generally speaking, everybody needs that paycheck.
Do human beings need to work? And I'm not talking about financially. Suppose we had a communist system or something similar that everybody was just paid
materially taken care of.
Materially taken care of, even if you're not, you know, you're not rich, all your needs are taken care of. Do we need to work on a regular basis, on a daily basis?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There have been studies done on this, right? Mm. And certainly it does seem to prevail that people who do nothing have no self-worth. I know as my wife and I were young parents and we had really little kids, we kept stumbling across these findings, these recommendations that you really need to make your kid, every one of your kids, understand that they are just indispensable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like one child who could be 2 years old, but you have to structure, let's say, the dinner time routine where you have to say, you know, your job, little 2 year old, is to make sure that the napkin holder is full.
Yeah.
That we have napkins. Otherwise, we can't eat.
You actually give jobs to two-year-olds?
Sure.
You have.
Something
okay.
that they're capable of, right? Like
okay.
filling the napkin holder, even if they do it badly.
All right.
Right?
So that they're not simply receivers. They're
right.
part of the giving.
And they're not just part of the giving. They're part of the work. And they understand the necessity of work and the necessity of contributing to the work, being a part of the productivity, so that you communicate it to them in such a way that they understand that we can't have dinner unless we've got napkins, and napkins is your job. And I have seen kids, they're sort of exalted by this. They're thinking, wow, that's how important I am. And so the fact that we're working, even if it's a job we hate, even if we understand that, you know, this job is really not me, this is doesn't fit my personality, but we have a sense of dignity in it because we see that it's fulfilling some purpose.
So it's natural to work because it's natural to not only take care of oneself and one's family, but it's natural to sense that you're contributing to something greater than yourself, the community.
Sure, exactly. Okay. And right. that we're not, you know, what do you want to say, like parasites. Mm-hmm. We're not barnacles, you know. We're we're not a drain on civilization.
And when we become a drain on civilization, we don't feel good about it.
Exactly. Which is why, you know, getting back to how I referred to my mother's comment mm-hmm. that, oh, I never want to be a burden to my children, right? We all have this sense that we want to be self-sufficient, mm. right? We might complain about what it takes to be self-sufficient. We might feel like we fall short of self-sufficiency. But the reality is that term self-sufficiency is valid to a point. But the fact is, none of us is really self-sufficient.
Fully and totally.
Right.
But you won't go so far as to say what Obama said during the 2008 campaign when he said, when he told business owners,
you didn't build that. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Can you do an Obama voice?
No, I can't.
No, try.
You didn't build that.
Oh, come on. You need a little work on that.
Yeah, I can't do that at all. So the point is, you know, no one can take 100% of the credit for what they achieve. However, you certainly can't deny someone the credit they're due.
Yeah.
And you can't say to someone, you know, the business that you built, you didn't build, right? Mm. They certainly did. Without them, that business wouldn't have been built, even if they relied on an army of other people to get it done.
So there's the one hand and the other hand. On the one hand, there would be no business for workers to work in if people didn't, rich people, let's face it, rich people didn't take the initiative to open a business.
Sure.
On the other hand, no matter how much...
Or even poor people who just, you know, put in their sweat equity to make it happen.
Yep. I'm thinking of bigger companies. Okay.
Sure.
You can do that. by contrast, on the other hand, you can say the same thing, that no matter how much initiative somebody has to open a business, if you don't have workers that help that along, and then, you know, what good is it?
Exactly. So, yep.
When we get back from the break, I want to go over with you the notion of justice, of workplace justice. There's been a lot of talk and struggle with that over the past century or two. And we're going to get into that, labor unions, and maybe even today's politics if we have a few moments. 978-454-4980 here at WCAP. Beneath the Surface Radio. I'm Paul Morano. I'll be back in a moment. And a welcome back. Glad you could join us. 17 minutes left. 16 minutes before the hour of 11 o'clock. I'll buy that.
We've got some work
here at BTS Radio. We certainly do. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. Paul Morano, your host, with today's guest, Mr. Kent Niebuhr, and we're talking about the dignity of work. Now, Mr. Kent, I assume that you are against the excessive exploits of capitalism as well as socialism.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So you see a problem with both extremes.
Well, it depends on what you mean by the excesses of those things. I mean, if you mean simple greed for capitalism, then that's greed is bad, right?
All right. It seems to me that whenever in the capitalist system, whenever people have profit as the primary center of their business over people, profit over people, that seems to be the principle of making excessive capitalism not work for everybody.
I don't know if the word is profit, though. Yes, if you're just thinking profit, but it's not profit versus people. I think it's profit versus the enterprise itself, right?
You do?
Because you could drive your business into the ground by just trying to squeeze money out of it, right? However, if you're thinking this business needs longevity, this business needs to stay in business, sort of a long-term view instead of a short-term view, then the business thrives. I once heard, I'll recommend Andreas Widmer's book, The Pope and the CEO. This is a guy who had been a Swiss guard with Pope John Paul II, but now he's an entrepreneur and he teaches at, I think it's Catholic University of America. Anyway, he wrote a book, and basically one of the things he says is, you know, the profits, when you're running a business, it's kind of like the air in the room. You don't think about the air in the room, but you think it, you're thinking about the business at hand. Right. You're kind of focused on the business, and then the profits take care of themselves, more or less.
I don't know about that. I think there are a lot of business owners that think about profits all the time.
Absolutely. Right. But
over the just wages and the just conditions of the people working for
them. Okay. And do you think, I think implicit in what you're saying is they're thinking about profits because all they care about is money.
I didn't say all they care about, but the question is, what is the primary, I guess, what is the primary value in any business? Is it the people, or is it the money making? In other words,
they're not opposed.
Of course, they're not opposed, but what is more valuable, more important, more central to any capitalist endeavor? Is it the dignity of the person or the amounts of the profit?
I would say it's no different from what most people do on an individual personal basis, not necessarily individual, but even their families. A father goes out and he says, I need to make money. I've got to make money. I've got to take care of my family. I need money. This is what every corporation's doing.
Yes.
Why? Because they're greedy? No, because they want to make sure that they can sustain themselves, right? It's because if you're making a good living, you're thinking, I've got to sustain this. So I better see to my business, make sure my business is being run well. And where does profit come into there? Does profit come in because you say, I want a bigger yacht, or I want a bigger mansion, or I want another mansion, or I want a blah, 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 blah? It could, but I think that's a little too facile. I think that's a little too superficial an analysis. I think what businesses are trying to do is sustain the business.
What is
to sustain the income?
What is a I know there's been a lot of laws in the past century or so relating to workplace conditions, child labor laws, and all of that stuff. But what do you think today, in 2016, is a just wage? Or is there one?
I don't really think you can pin it down.
Okay. There is no just wage.
I think it's so dependent upon an individual circumstances.
Well,
go ahead.
Before you, for instance.
Yeah.
I meant a living wage. A just wage relates to the kind of work you do and the kind of company you're in.
Sure.
Is there, do you believe, in 2016, a living wage?
For an individual to survive? To live?
Yes.
If that's what a living wage is.
To live in a dignified way, whatever that means.
Okay. You know, it's really hard to say, and I think a lot of that is in the eye of the beholder, so to speak. I know people who have thought the greatest dignity that they have is being extremely humble and living in extremely humble conditions. And so I know people, or a single individual, I should say, who actually went to his boss and said, you need to lower my salary.
Okay.
Now, this is obviously extremely rare. I don't know how many people do this, but there are people, for instance, if I'm a young man, I'm right out of college, I'm not married, no children, no commitments, not even a mortgage, and I want a job, I might walk in and say, you know, apply for a job, and the guy will say, well, we decided to go with someone else. I might even say, hire me and you could pay me half or less or something.
Are you not going to give me a living wage for 2016?
I really don't know, because my experience is so bound up in my circumstances. I'm a father of seven children. I live, you know, in a suburb, and, you know, I kind of know what that takes. But I can't really tell you, you know, look, if someone has a one bedroom apartment versus a home in the suburbs versus owns a farm versus a penthouse, in downtown.
Related question. Yeah. Should there be a minimum wage?
I don't think there should be.
There should not be a minimum wage.
I think what minimum wages tend to do, by and large, is reduce the number of jobs available.
Okay. And so that's particularly younger people and non-traditional workers are unemployed because of this, because of minimum wage.
Right. And what it also does is it stifles growth of the economy in terms of having capital to reinvest in the business. So in other words, if I've got to pay one employee, say, $15 an hour, which is the number we're hearing all the time now, versus, say, 10, then I can't hire another person. Right. So now there's only one job instead of two. I can't take that $5 and reinvest it in my business so that down the road I could hire another person.
What do you think of the argument that in times past, no matter what job you had, it was a living wage for a man and his family? Today, that's not the case. Does that bother you?
That definitely bothers me a lot. I think that...
But you're arguing against it.
No, I'm not. Well, because I think every employee, what he's putting on the table is his work, whatever his qualifications are, right? And he can negotiate. She can negotiate. Any worker can negotiate based upon what they bring to the table. And then it's a question of what they're willing to settle for, right? Now, look, I would love to take my qualifications and get a job that pays me $1 million for it. But there's not a $1 million market for my qualifications, I'm afraid, right? So I have to work within what's available. There's always going to be this sort of dynamic tension between employer and employee.
Then would you say that there are certain jobs that you should not expect to be able to live on?
For instance,
there are. Okay.
Yeah, right.
And in those jobs, and let's just make it concrete. The typical stereotypical concrete job of a McDonald's worker.
Yep.
You're saying a McDonald's worker should not, by its very nature, should not expect to live on a full-time salary at McDonald's.
I agree. However, if this is a person who, let's say it's a single person, has roommates, where four of them are working at McDonald's and they're able to pool their resources or, you know, split the rent somewhere, then you can live on that. Or it's a husband and a wife.
So certain businesses depend on young people who have no dependents and can find roommates.
High school students,
Can barely get by.
There's a reason why there's the phrase paper boy and not paper man. Right. Mm-hmm. You don't expect a full grown man to be making a living delivering newspapers. Right. Now, I realize in this day and age, there's not a lot of newspapers getting delivered. But the reason why is because we expect a 10, 12, 14 year old kid to be fulfilling this role.
And such a job should not expect any kind of minimum wage.
I would say in a case like that, if a kid is willing to work for $2 an hour and that satisfies whatever his needs are, then that's fine.
Okay.
I think
everything the federal government is doing about this minimum wage thing and the state governments, they're wasting their time and they're wrecking the economy, according to you. Right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I do.
Okay. Yeah. And would you also say, and this is something
I should say, it's kind of subtle. So I don't think it's like these people are all just absolute morons because they don't see that. I think it's very subtle. And, you know, even in my description of, you know, being able to hire another employee, that's even a simplistic way of describing it. But that's the dynamic.
I'd once thrown out this to my students when we were talking about this in ethics class, that when there is a minimum wage and when the minimum wage goes up, it seems like all salaries go up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And when all salaries go up, it is as if the minimum wage never occurred.
Yeah.
And hence, if you think about it mathematically, there's an argument at least to be made that if you have a minimum wage, you should have a maximum wage. Now think about that for a sec. If there's a minimum wage, there should be a maximum wage, because then everybody's salaries don't go up. There's a ceiling on both ends.
But then the problem is you're stifling growth. and you're stifling ingenuity and you're stifling incentives, right? I mean, my incentive for going to work is that I get the paycheck. Now, there are other incentives, right? I get the paychecks, therefore I can have a roof over my head. I get the paycheck, therefore food on the table, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of, a business has to think about the future, right?
Yeah.
It can't just say, well, I'll make this money today and then I don't care what happens tomorrow. It has to think, how are we going to build, you know, with, you know, a long-term forecast, right? So it has to you go into a bank and you say, I want to borrow money to start my own business. They say, what's your business plan? Right? They don't say, well, okay, we'll lend you $1 million, therefore you're a millionaire. No, we're going to lend you $1 million. How are you going to, you know, make this grow? How are you going to make this a good investment, right? So I think as soon as you start putting a floor under salaries and a cap on salaries, you artificially stifle a certain the majority of incentives for people to do what they do.
I would agree with that, but it seems to me, and this is the only argument I'm making, that if there is a minimum wage, there should be a maximum wage.
Right. So just as illogical as a minimum wage is, so therefore is a maximum wage.
But it almost creates a little more logic if there is a minimum wage, because then not everybody's salaries don't go up. And the person on the bottom remains still on the bottom as bottom as he was before the minimum wage was raised.
As you sort of said before, there are certain jobs that by their nature are on the bottom of the salary spectrum.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? Like I said, a paper boy. Nobody expects a paper boy to drive a Lamborghini.
All right. So you're against the minimum wage. Are you for or against labor unions as in principle?
In principle, no.
I said for or against. You can't say no
to that. Oh,
I'm
sorry. In principle, I am not against labor unions in principle.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a place for negotiation and all that kind of...
Absolutely. Just as
thing.
I said, if an individual is going for a job and is going to negotiate their salary, okay, you want to hire me. Well, I want this, I want that, I want this, right? Well, I think you could do that collectively too. I don't have a problem with that. But just as you could talk about abuses of corporate America, you could talk about abuses of unions as well.
Mr. Kent, any last words about this notion of the dignity of work? You get about 10 seconds.
Everything we do can have dignity, right? As long as it's not immoral, whatever we're doing, whether it's washing dishes, piloting a ship, or running a major corporation, it's dignified.
And
we have to build humility into our sense of dignity about work.
And as some saints have said, including Saint Teresa the Little Flower, if you do it for the glory of God, you're doing wondrous things every single day.
Pray as if everything depends upon God, and work as if everything depends upon you.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Vinyl Girl and Cindy's Vinyl Vault up next. I'm Paul Morano. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface. We will see you next week. Same time, same channel.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
BreadBox Media Programming is brought to you by Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com, for faith, fellowship, and love.